everybody. Welcome to the Color Computer Conference, coordinated Color Computer Conference. I'd like to just say something up front about the previous conferences. And the first one was downloaded 278 times, which I'm really proud of. And the second one was downloaded 190 times. Haven't got much feedback, but those are good numbers for what I'm doing here. Today's conference, we have Marty Goodman. Hello, Marty.
Good evening.
The way I like to run these conferences is very open. If anybody who's currently connected would like to ask a question, just pipe up and ask your question. I'll probably say your name for posterity, but otherwise I like to keep it really loose. So, Marty, how are you tonight?
Doing reasonably well. This, I should make a small announcement, is the first ever Skype conference I have participated in. I'm rather a novice at Skype technology, other than making individual private calls on it.
Well, they certainly try to make it easy.
Well, here we are.
Yeah. Marty, I wanted to talk to you about the Color Computer.
Okay, I hated that.
And your life in general. But let's start off. Let's learn a little bit more about you. Where were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn, New York, in the Crown Heights neighborhood, in 1950.
Now, you ended up in California. Did you do all your growing up in New York?
All my formative years up through to age 16 were spent in the city of New York in the 50s and early to mid 60s, and then off for 4 years of college in Cambridge area, Massachusetts, and then to the West Coast, where I've been pretty much since then, except in the last 12 years, I've been spending 3 months a year in New York.
Did the West Coast culture really appeal to you, that sort of thing?
Well, I guess I saw a change back in 71. I was listening to Frank Zappa lampoon California Crazies and thought to myself, I got to check this out for myself. So I decided to go out to the West Coast. I guess, though, I've always thought of myself as something of a New Yorker.
I see. When was your first connection with the Color Computer?
Well, it's kind of curious. I was working as the paid physician at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic in the early 1980s. And one of the staff I was working with knew a computer guru, and I mentioned I was interested in getting some sort of a home computer. And she says, oh, you've got to speak to Craig. And I was brought over to his place, and it was this darkened apartment, and there were like zillions of the then popular home computers. There was an Apple, there was an old Intel IMSI, there was a Commodore, there was an Atari, and the guy was demonstrating how he was connecting on ARPANET. This was, of course, before either the web or the internet. And he was showing me all these amazing things he could do. He could get up to 300 baud communication. It was pretty amazing. And spent a great deal of time showing me all of his toys, and they were many and varied, and showing me examples of his various sorts of hacking online. And I said, well, okay, but what kind of computer do you recommend? And he said, well, here's a real sleeper. And he took me over to a tiny little corner among all this technology, and there was a little color computer. And he said, this thing packs a real punch. It's got this 6809. It's real advanced. Da, 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 and it's got this incredibly good color graphics. You want to get this one. So I got it. Turned out a friend of mine's son wanted to get rid of his because he wanted a more dedicated gaming machine, and I got a deal on one, and that's how it started.
That's wonderful. I'm sorry, what was that friend's name again?
I think his name was Craig. I forget the last name. Oh. For all I know, he's still involved with computers. But this was a while back. We're talking 25 years ago, and somehow my memory is not crystal clear on the details.
Now, did you have much computing experience prior to the color computer?
Well, in high school, I went to Columbia Science Honors Program, and they taught me Fortran assembly language and Fortran on IBM mainframe, a 7090 and a 7094. And I learned to write in assembly an emulator for a hypothetical machine. And then our high school in New York was the very first public high school, Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn, was the very first public high school to get its own computer. And they got a Monrobot 11-2000. It was made by Monroe Business Machines. They made mechanical calculators. And this thing had a full 2K of memory on a rotating magnetic drum. This was in 66. It was about the size of a sizable desk. Its output was to an IBM typewriter and to punch paper tape, and input was via tape in the typewriter. And I learned its assembly language and programmed it to print an ASCII graphic strip tease output, to the delight of my teachers in high school. And I learned when working with that computer, I learned to optimize its speed, because it had this rotating drum and it could access the drum three times per revolution if you spaced the axes right physically on the drum, which prepared me years later to write fast disk I/O programs for the Cocos floppies.
Yes, the venerable 17 WDC 17793.
And the limitations of the fact that you couldn't read or write one sector right after another on the disk. You had to, but you could write, I think, what was it, Steve, every third sector or something to that effect?
Yeah, Disk Basic was set up with formatting every third or fourth, but the best you could ever hope was every other sector.
Aha, okay, yeah.
So once you got the color computer, like all of us, I'm sure the rainbow wasn't far behind.
No, I honestly can't recall how I stumbled across Rainbow Magazine. I may have first hooked up to, I don't know if folks recall, back in those days, there were local computer hobbyist groups dedicated to the particular machine that one had. And I may have bumped into Rainbow via some local Bay Area, color computer group that got together. I can't exactly recall how I first discovered it, but yeah, then I started reading it. And then at some early stage, I don't know how many years into Rainbow, one or two or three, something like that. I wrote a letter to the editor, just sort of on a whim. It was kind of a half joking but half serious letter about how I'd moved and I had to get a new room for my computer or something like that. It was some silly little human interesty type comment thing, and Lonnie printed it, and I guess I. That sharpened my interest in the magazine.
So I did a little talking with Steve Bjork earlier, and he had a really interesting story about you and Zaxxon.
Is this, Steve, you're referring to the issue where we where I first met you?
Oh, definitely. It was a classic meeting of two Coco celebrities, or who would become Coco celebrities later. Do you want to tell the story, or you want me to tell the story?
I would encourage you to proceed. I remember parts of it, but I certainly remember the concern and ambivalence with which I approached you. I wasn't quite sure how you were going to greet me, but I would be delighted to hear your version of it, which I suspect is quite correct.
Well, let's put it this way. Meeting Marty Goodman is always a very vivid memory. It's Marty does bring a lot of emotion to his visit, to say the least. It was a time in my life that was very interesting, because I had been working with both Datasoft as their head of software engineering, and at the same time just completed over a year and a half's worth of work involved in getting Zaxxon to the color computer, because that also involved me working with Sega, and it turns out I ended up working on rewriting Zaxxon a little bit for the American market. What they had from the Japanese market wasn't quite going to sell well. It hadn't been testing well. So that was really how we were able to get it. It wasn't just the fact that we're willing to pay the money. We're willing to help them make their game into a great seller. And then we got the rights for Zaxxon for a whole bunch of systems. Anyways, so I've been working on that, and I just completed the Zaxxon floppy disk and the cassette version I was working on, and we had the West Coast Computer Fair. You remember those, Marty?
Yep. Those were an institution.
they were mostly held up in the Bay Area. One did come down to California, in Southern California, Los Angeles Convention Center. They found out that wasn't a good place to be. They had to stay up in Silicon Valley area. But I think this was probably third annual or fourth annual West Coast Computer Fair. Anyways, Datasoft, for the first time, was going to have a booth at the show, and they're premiering Zaxxon and all these other games that they've created, and they were very excited about sharing what they had, you know, a fully licensed version of Zaxxon and what we were able to get on the machines. Well, I hadn't been able to get up there yet, but I got on the first day of the show, I got a call from my boss. And the head of the company, and he was outraged by unbelievable gall this person had to take a photocopy sheets of how to break Zaxxon's copy protection and put them next to the color computer that was demonstrating it at the booth. Could not believe it. He's reading back these instructions to me saying, will this break this? And I'm kind of going, I'm shocked by have somebody broke it already, because the game had only been out in the market for about 2 weeks. And anyways, I have some friends that run some of the different computer societies, and especially the Color Computer Society. And I had them track down who would do such a thing. And sure enough, they came up with the name Marty Goodman. Now, I had never heard of Marty Goodman before, but they, you know, they were saying, oh, well, he's really a good guy and like that. And I find out, you know, they told me a little bit more. First of all, he was a card-carrying communist at the time. And he lives in Berkeley, belongs there. He's definitely part of that culture.
That interests me, Steve. And I certainly don't deny it. I'm proud of my leftist background and my current leftist position. But it's interesting that that was put forward in the first breath as a description to me. I'm delighted to hear it, but I didn't realize that that was being talked about in the world of the color computer.
Yeah. Well, it was just, you know, they were trying to explain who is this guy that would put how to break the copy protection for a game at the company that's trying to sell the game that put the copy protection in the first place. Anyways,
that was sort of more an expression of my own personality, that I didn't really want to hurt anybody. And in fact, that's why I chose to put it there, where, of course, it would be immediately spotted. Folks would know about it. I assumed it would be immediately taken away. The idea was not to harm. The idea was to perform a grand jest.
The grand jest. And I do understand it's that everybody has the right to make sure their software works for into, you know, forever. You know, if what happens, you know, what happens to this one disk if it breaks? You know, I understand completely. But well,
you were very good about that. Candidly, you brought me around over the course of the next year or two or three. I think it only took a couple of years to, you know, appreciate what's involved in making software and what's involved in making your living making software and all of that. And frankly, my own feelings about all that shifted considerably in large part through my acquaintance with you.
And anyways, there's a little bit more to the story. Before I met Marty and before I got up there, I started finding out more about Marty. And of course, I was a little upset, to say the least. And I said in jest to my friends, I'm going to send the Luigi brothers up there to explain life to Marty. Probably having something to do with his knees being, you know, kind of cut off there.
You mean the famous Sicilian orthopedic surgeon, Luigi?
Yes. Well, Luigi brothers. It's two guys. They make sure the job is done right. Anyways. I don't know if Marty took it literally or if Marty realized that somebody was mad, but when I, for the first day or two when I was at the West Coast Computer Fair, when he got a clue that I was in the area, from what I understand from my spies, you were doing your best to avoid me for a little while.
I was trying to check out the situation. I didn't know what the hell kind of a character I deal with. I knew you had reason to be less than feeling really warm to me.
But we did have, we finally did meet and we did talk, and I got a kick out of the fact that you were starting to think the Luigi brothers were real. But since then,
I was concerned about your ire, and I and folks have been known to express ill will in some fairly strong ways.
true. But you know, still, we managed to become great friends. I had some great times when I'd come up to the San Francisco region. You have invited me on your infamous 3-week hikes, which I have always declined.
You should have gone on one of them. You would have loved it.
I would have loved it, but I have to admit, my hiking, I usually keep to nothing more than one overnight. And these days, I enjoy the comfort of a Regency so much, I just can't stand roughing it anymore. So, but Marty and I did become very good friends. We had a lot of good conversations, and he introduced me to some people. I think I met your friend that introduced you to the different computers.
You're referring to – oh, you may have met – I think his name was Craig, as I said. You certainly did meet – I'm sure you met Peter.
Who's the gentleman that had the really long hair?
Mike, yeah. He appears to be about 4 feet tall and hair down to his heels. Michael.
Yes.
That would be Michael Kahn, who I was just speaking to the other day, who is doing very well and lives in the Mission in San Francisco.
Good.
Is actually enjoying life and doing quite well, I'm happy to report.
Well, Marty hanged around in an interesting group of people. As I said, Marty lives in Berkeley. He belongs in Berkeley. He doesn't ride a bicycle. You ride a what type of bicycle?
Well, it's a bicycle, but it's a recumbent bicycle, the kind where you're lying back somewhat more horizontal than on an ordinary bicycle. And in the one I'm riding now, your feet are out in front of the front wheel.
Okay. I have to admit, I'm more traditional with the typical beachcomber bike and like that. But
they're very comfortable.
Thing I've learned about you is always you are the type of person that has your own spirit. You do the things that you like to do. And the thing is, basically, though, you do everything from a good heart.
Steve, it's very kind of you to say that, especially considering how strained our initial acquaintance was. But no,
especially if this is being recorded.
but it's really true. Steve and I would not have become the friends we did if Steve wasn't I took a long view, was a very broad-minded and not a petty sort of fellow. And that struck me early on, and I'm delighted we were able to, after certain matters had to be settled, we ended up becoming, much to my pleasure, very 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 fast friends in the world of the color computer. And I've always seen Steve as one of the true gentlemen among the folks in the orbit of the color computer.
Marty, do you remember any details about the cracking of Zaxxon?
You know, this has been a very long time. What is certainly the case is that one of the early ways I gained notoriety in among color computers, sort of the cheap shot means of cracking programs. It's a lot easier to crack a program than to write one, I want to be very quick to point out. And it was, you know, at that point there was glamour attached to doing that sort of thing. There were various kinds of people who did it, some out of malice, wanting to hurt those who sold it, some just for the sheer challenge. There were issues, as Steve actually alluded to earlier, of the question of the principle of backing up software, which there's a lot of validity to that, but then it's a question of how far you use that argument and how you use it. I just mainly liked the challenge. I later became associated with the principled argument about backing things up. But mostly for me, it was just the delightful challenge of working out ways to do it. And it was, you know, a level of software challenge that was within my, that was challenging to me, but within my grasp. Whereas I could never have written a video game. That was beyond my ability.
All right. You're about to say something, Steve, when I cut you off.
Well, just going on about the fact of Marty's and my relationship and how things changed and like that. I will tell you, though, that release of the crack to break Zaxxon caused Tandy not to come out with the disc version of Zaxxon. They only sold the cassette. And the we had to cancel the order, and the royalties on that order was $250,000.
I certainly did not intend to hurt anyone with that. I should point out that later on I came out with effective means of putting those ROM packs onto disc.
Right. Well, in any case, the whole point of the thing is that that is an example where I can sit there and say, because of piracy, it did hurt the software developers. And, you know, that's why I say it's a balancing act between what do you do to protect your rights to make sure that people will buy it when the market that you're trying to sell to are kids, and the kids are very willing to copy the stuff back then as they are now. And, you know, it's trying to keep things honest. But to show that even though I have direct costs and all these things that have happened over the time, Marty Goodman is the only person I ever immortalized in a video game.
That was a remarkable honor. I was blown away by that, quite frankly.
Well, Marty, I have to admit that you have a great reputation when it comes to these different color computer shows, especially Rainbow Fest and like that. And when I was trying to do a souvenir game to help promote the Atlanta Cocoa Fest, I mean, that was the reason for the project. That's the reason why I want to put you in it, because you are such a star in the cocoa community.
Well, you're too kind, Steve. but yeah, I was really quite stunned when I learned of it. You had not told me in advance, and I basically learned of it at pretty much around the time you'd finished it, and it came as quite a shock to me.
I did get you to record some sound bites for it, though.
Yes, yes, yes,
yes. Those are sound bites used in the game?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, how did you do that without him knowing about its existence?
No, he asked me to record. I wasn't taking it seriously, to be honest with you. I thought maybe it was a joke, or maybe it was a much smaller scale thing. Yeah, no, he had approached me. That's true.
We kept it small, and then just before it went off to the show, I also sent Marty a copy up, and you know, he was very taken by it, too, at the time that, you know, this thing was actually a full-fledged game. He just thought it was a quickie little demo that you would see.
Right. So, just for the record, this is the game Marty's Nightmare?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Well, another thing you might want to mention here is that you at one point were either a semi or, you may correct me if you wish, you did performances as a magician, if I'm not mistaken, Steve. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I was a magician in Northern Nevada during the later 80s. Matter of fact, while I was performing up there, I got a copy of the new Radio Shack magazine, or, you know, catalog. And in there, hastily put in at the last second, was a little card about a TRS-8. Now, I've been playing with the computers and like that, but I was doing the summer gigs up there in Nevada. I saw the card and I said, okay, Radio Shack is going to have a computer in 5,000 stores. Overnight, they have over doubled the number of stores you can buy a computer.
Mm.
This was a game changer. And at that point there, that was my decision. I'm going to have to stop doing the fun stuff like magic. I'm going to have to settle down and really get into the stuff. And I poured myself into the Radio Shack color computer, started producing software. And then I got noticed with the color computer, and then that continued up. And
I mentioned that, though, because, I mean, you're something, you have in you something of the sense of a performer. And although I have never particularly concertedly professionally performed, I've always been something of a ham, and that was another bond between us.
Yeah, you are when you would do your seminars, or even when you're talking with a group of people, Marty, you look upon not only just conveying the information, you want people to enjoy the time with you. And that is the core of an entertainer.
And the other part of it, and I'm sure this is as true of you as of me, you enjoy doing it. One enjoys doing it. It's a pleasure. One gets pleasure doing that.
Well, it's like when I do an illusion and I explain to people, I do the illusion once for the entertainment. I'm trying to bring some entertainment to your life. I never do an illusion a second time because I don't want to become an educator. Because when you see an illusion the second time, you can usually figure it out.
Yeah.
Marty,
it certainly was a very strange road. The entry into the world of the color computer, and it was. I mean, I didn't go into it trying to be someone known in the world of that thing. I was certainly at the start of it. I was just having a grand old time, and things just sort of happened. Quite frankly, it was that was sort of the whole. But for many who were involved in that. That was one of the magical things. It wasn't a very, in most respects, obviously there are exceptions, but in most respects, it wasn't a manipulated, orchestrated, controlled world. It was a world of real individuals and people who were there because they liked what they were doing. I'm thinking of another person not present, Art Flexer, who I continue to be in touch with. I had, it's funny, actually, two or three weeks ago, he was over at my place in New York. He's retired now, living in the New Jersey area. And he dropped by my place in New York, and he asked my assistance in moving a motherboard from one laptop to another. So there we were on my kitchen table just a few weeks ago, and I was taking 50 screws out of this thing and moving this motherboard over and exchange swapping boards and what have you. And, gee, it was just like the old days. It was a really nice moment. But, you know, Art was a professor in Miami, and a lot of the people – Steve was one of the few real professionals in the world of the computer. A lot of the people involved were amateurs who just dabbled in it, and for one reason or other made enough contributions so they got known. Most of what I did, there were some exceptions, but most of what I did was act as a mouthpiece for the insights and the wisdom of many others who I bumped into who didn't want to be in the spotlight. Most spectacular of all, of course, was the late Peter Ryan, who had written Graphicom. And he didn't want any part of any publicity, and he and I had become good friends. And I said, look, folks need to know about this. So I said, okay, you know, you present it. And I tried as far as possible to make clear that I was not taking credit for its creation, just that I was, if you will, its promoter or its publicizer.
And let me ask you, Marty, the infamous WeFax, is that another case of that?
Peter Ryan, he wrote that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm pretty sure. No thinking about it. I made that clear in the article at the time. I certainly in no way claim credit for it. But Peter at the time was very secretive and really wanted an extremely low profile, and so that's what he got. I urged. He showed up at some of the Cocoa Fest, one or two of them. There was only one on the West Coast. Isn't that right, Steve? I think just one. Palo Alto Cocoa Fest, I think that was.
Well, no, okay. They did some down in the,
Irvine.
Long Beach.
I'm sorry. West Coast was my apologies. This was my San Francisco Bay centric view of things. I mean the Northern California. There was only one in Northern California.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of trial, Rainbow Fest. There was even one done in Texas that was a flop. Hmm. And they found that the one that did the best was in the Midwest in Chicago. They had a large Cocoa Fest. A large cocoa group that they could work
right.
with on that.
Right. The San Francisco one didn't do very well at all. It was a big disappointment to those putting it on, as I understood it. Which was curious, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, like down here in LA, we don't have a professional football team because nobody wants to spend the time being inconvenienced by going to a stadium and having to sit in 60 or 70 degree weather. And then look at Green Bay Packers. You got guys sitting out there in negative 20 degrees. Snow's falling on them. All their hats have snow on the brim, and they're out there enjoying the game. Yeah. Who figures?
I'd like to speak up as a Packer fan from Green Bay originally, and I've been to a 5-degree game. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. All right. But anyway, yeah, no, so Peter showed up at the West Coast show. I think you may have met him there, Steve, and I'm not sure.
I think I probably did.
He crossed your path. I do vividly remember his crossing your path. And in fact, he wanted to meet you. He was impressed by the games you had written, and he made a point of asking me to introduce him to you, and I believe I did.
Well, something I do want to get on this recording is Marty is definitely from an era which was the beginning of the computer industry, and he is definitely a kindred spirit with most of them, which are all about is we've got a problem. Let's solve it. Oh, here's the answer. I can't wait to give it to you. You know, because then we all take in the fact that this problem has been solved by the communion, by the group and like that. Nobody really wanted to take that much credit for it. And of course, you had a lot of friends that wanted to get stuff out. You were the mouthpiece. You got the stuff out for them. But if you want to learn more about this particular industry back at that time, there's a great series that was put out by PBS. It was called it's not Revenge of the Nerds, it's the Triumph of the Nerds. That's it. Triumph of the Nerds. Especially I think it's available on Netflix now. You can rent it from there. And it is an unbelievable series because it'll take you from the very beginnings, like of Altar and Bill Gates having to sleep in a motel that was basically doubled as a brothel for the hookers in town, all the way up to about the mid-90s and how everything happened. And there's a lot about the culture, about the West Coast Computer Fair, how this one guy always held meetings in his hot tub. It is great.
Along those lines, and also along the lines of it's a small world type of thing. Just a few weeks back, I had a meeting with an individual who the context of the meeting was to get access to a library he owned because I'm doing a project archiving to digital PDF format certain old leftist literature from the 20s and 30s. And this individual owned one of the more extensive libraries in the world of this material. And then I learned something else about him. He was the guy who designed the switching power supply for the Apple II. And in fact, if you speak of Wozniak and Jobs as the two guys in the garage, well, he was the third guy in the garage at the time.
He was employee number three, huh?
Well, pretty much, sort of. My understanding is that his contribution to designing an economical switching power supply, and you recall, Steve, in those days, almost all computers used linear power supplies, and the Apple IIs was, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if you feel I'm wrong, but I'm under the impression quite rightly that was one of the first wide applications of a switching power supply to a home computer.
Definitely was. And one other thing about it, the way the switching power supply was done as a separate module, they only needed to UL proof the power supply because the output was all lower voltage and didn't need to be UL proof. So every time they changed the motherboard, they didn't have to send the whole kit caboodle to get UL approved.
Well, in any case, so this individual who I knew of and met in the context of a leftist archive project turns out to be, you know, one of the major hardware hackers in the world of home computing, among many other accomplishments of his. It was quite interesting. I go to his place to talk with him and negotiate access to his materials, and there's this 200 megahertz oscilloscope on the kitchen table, and he's putzing around with a circuit board on it and stuff. But the fellow's in his 70s now, and he's still at it, hacking away.
That's the reason why I say you've got to watch Triumph the Nerds. You understand that the culture that got created in the 60s and it was still going on in the 70s was the key for the computer revolution when it happened, because it was us against the big guys, against the corporations. You know, it really was that Apple 1984 commercial happening at that time.
Yeah, back in the days of the Coco, I remember how wistfully we were thinking, oh, the Coco should be able to take on the Apple. And some of us were critical of the way Tandy marketed it at the time, rightly or wrongly. We certainly were critical. I remember a time at you probably recall, Steve, at one point I got associated with a trademark phrase of mine. I was referring to the Tandy executives as, quote, cretinous chimpanzees. And let me just see who's calling me here. Never mind. We can ignore that. Anyway, and at one point I was at one of the Cocoa Fests and this person approaches me and says, "Hello, I just want you to know I'm one of the cretinous chimpanzees." It was, you know, one of the higher execs from Tandy approaching me who had apparently heard of that epithet of mine.
Oh, trust me, the folks in the Tandy halls knew exactly what people thought of them, but they also knew that they were, you know, they're there to create money for the corporation. So
I was very impressed. Anyone who could come up and say, "Hi, I'm one of the cretinous chimpanzees," I respect such a person. That's somebody who has a certain pizzazz, and I respect that.
On that side note of those chimpanzees, when they did a Rainbow Fest in Fort Worth, Texas, which they only did once and they realized it was a big mistake, they had a key executive from Tandy to talk to the group for their little keynote thing. And, well, they sure picked the wrong guy. Instead of picking somebody from the color computer side, which all of them were told not to talk to us, they picked somebody from accounting. Basically, he was the financial manager. And he spoke of marketing and financial. You thought he was talking to a bunch of people that were from the stock exchange. And when he said, in closing, everybody just yelled, "Hooray!"
This is from one of those internet mailing humor things under the title "When Insults Had Class," and one of the lines in that one was, "He can brighten a room just by leaving it."
Yes, everybody wanted him to finish up. They'd rather listen to Lonnie talk, and that tells you something.
Apropos of absolutely nothing, I want to lay out just one of the other ones from that list, which went, this is attributed to Clarence Darrow, the great attorney. It went, "I have never killed a man, but there have been some obituaries I have read with great relish." Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Marty, I'd like to hear about the process of writing that first letter to the editor to the Rainbow and then becoming a columnist.
The journey to the column was the hardware hacking column Cocoa Consultations, yes, was its name. And basically, I was increasingly tinkering away at things and, you know, encouraged by the fact that a letter was printed. And it was, as I said, a thoroughly frivolous sort of letter. Sincere, but frivolous. And I began learning how to work on the color computer's hardware and how to make this, that, or the other little board or improvement. And I suddenly got excited and eager to share these little projects. And I started writing them up and sending them in. And eventually one was accepted for publication and then another one. And the next thing I knew, Jim Reed called me up and said, "How would you like to write a column And we talked about how it would work, answering questions. I think by that point I was beginning to be visible on Delphi, the color. Well, I think at that point, early it was CompuServe, and then it switched to Delphi, and I was answering questions assiduously. And Jim Reed said, "Well, you know, why don't you write a column?" And so I said, "Gee, I'm honored. That would be great." I mean, the notion that somebody would want me to write for them on a regular basis was very flattering. And so that began the Cocoa Consultations column. But interspersed with that, anytime I could think of some neat little project and managed to do it and managed to check it out, I would try to find a way to write it up and see if I could share it. And so that produced a number of Rainbow articles.
Like the WeFax?
WeFax was not mine at all. That was a project by Peter Ryan. And I said, "You know, Peter, if you want to get word out about this, the thing to do is to have this presented to color computer owners through Rainbow." And he thought about it a bit and then decided he liked the idea. And so basically he gave the go-ahead to present his work through the Rainbow. And so then I proceeded to write the article that would present it. I think we put
the WeFax program in the form of something in ASCII that you could type in and then a little routine that would turn it into the machine language program that it was, and then placed, I forget whether we placed online at the time or whether in those early days we just gave an address to write to where you could get a disc from us or a cassette tape and we'd give you the program and its source code and, you know, everything else we had on it, that sort of thing. But Peter died in, I think it was 94. It was very, very tragic. Died at age 34 of AIDS. And that was a great loss to, I think, just people in general. Quite a remarkable fellow, that Peter.
Indeed. Do you have any recollections about Lonnie Falk?
Yeah, I never got to know Lonnie really well. And we were very different people, so we didn't relate really closely, but Lonnie was, at least most of the time, there were occasional exceptions, I have to confess, but most of the time he was very nice to me. I guess, you know, he recognized that I was helping him with his magazine, and I never overtly bit his hand, as it were. I tried, even in my wilder moments, to be reasonably respectful towards him, both publicly and privately. And I would say we had an effective and cordial working relationship would be the best way to say it. We didn't cross paths all that much. Most of my close relationship with Rainbow Magazine, per se, was via its editor, Jim Reed, who was quite a fellow, quite a delightful fellow, and really gave me a whole other perspective on who and what an editor was. I'd always thought that editors were these nasty sons of bitches that are going to piss on your immortal words and whatever. In fact, whenever Jim attacked anything I wrote, he made it better. And I began to appreciate that and appreciate what a good editor does. Jim was a really good editor. It was he, I think, who came up with the phrase of referring to me as the Howard Cosell of the color computer. I think that was Jim's creation, that phrase.
So Jim Reed, the editor of Rainbow Magazine, he encouraged you to write articles and all that?
Most of the encouragement was from me. I was a natural. I was and am. What the fuck? Excuse me. Shouldn't be saying that in public, shall we now? I was a natural, was and am a natural exhibitionist. That was another bond between me and Steve. We both have some of that in us. What he did was he made what I did better. I did not have a lot of skill and experience at writing. I mean, I'm good with words. I can communicate well, but I was not an experienced writer. And Jim was a damn good editor, and he made my articles look better than they were when they were submitted. It was very, very seldom that he either asked for or suggested a change that I didn't like. There might have been one or two occasions in all the articles. But I mean, even stuff that I thought he wouldn't let me get away with, if it was good stuff, he would let it go by. I remember there was one how-to article that I was writing, and I had always wanted to incorporate this little jest into a how-to hardware project. I had seen somebody else use it years ago as a joke, and I always wanted to use it myself. And finally, I can't remember which it was, but there truly was one Marty Goodman Rainbow how to make this hardware project article where I did it, you know, step one, step two, step three, step four, and we had like step six, be sure to do step five before step four in order to avoid lethal shock hazard. And that was my way of reminding people that you're supposed to read all the steps before you do the project.
Now, is Jim Reed still alive?
I was about to ask you that, or ask anyone else that. Does anyone know the fate of Jim Reed? I don't know what happened to him. Does anyone out there know? I guess not. No, I just as you asked that, I was wondering the same thing. I don't know if he's still with us. He didn't watch his weight very well, and that would be a health risk. And a lot of time has passed, but you know, what can I say? I wish him well. I hope he's either well or that he had a quick and gentle passing.
Okay. Well, the Rainbow years were long and fruitful. Do you have anything else that you'd like to mention as far as cocoing in its earnest before the color computer ran its course?
As far as cocoing, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. One thing I wanted to say was that I still feel very warmly towards that period. I've done other really neat things in life, and I've had other sources of gratification and challenge and what have you. But those were really neat. That was a really neat, special, very special and very exciting time. And, it wouldn't have happened if not for everybody else involved with it. The people who were, like Steve, who were the major forces behind making that happen, and all the others who knew and loved the color computer. It was a very unique world. It was, it was a big business, and Steve and others made a living at it, and there was money, as Steve pointed out, at stake. And yet somehow that whole community managed to stay at a remarkably real and human level, more so than many other things when money enters the picture. And that was really, really nice to be a part of that. I know this sounds like, your typical retrospective BS, but I mean it very, very sincerely. It was a very special time. It really was.
I totally agree. I was a little younger than most, when I had my Coco and didn't venture out into the community at large. Everything I knew was from the Rainbow. That's definitely sure.
Well, if I could add something too, is that everybody went to these Coco Fests, these Rainbow Fests and like that. And it was one great big group of people. Marty would be just chatting with people. I mean, the whole idea of Marty's nightmare is he's having to get to the seminar. Meanwhile, people are constantly going after him with these questions. And, of course, Marty's going to answer. They know he's the go-to guy to find out these hardware and software things and like that. And that was the whole crux of that game. But it was truly that way back then. Everybody got together. They had a great time. We look forward to the shows because it is one time we can socialize. And one thing that happens, and it's been going on now for just about 20 years, is after Rainbow gave up on the Coco Fest, they won't die. The group out there, Glenside, every year, and this will be their 20th annual last Coco Fest.
Oh, my. Oh my!
Did you realize that 20 years they've been doing this show?
That is genuinely staggering.
Rainbow never made it 10 years with theirs, and they've done it twice as many. And Marty, you really need to come out.
It's in May.
It's like the weekend before Memorial Day weekend.
You know what? I wish I could say I had an excuse for not having showed, and I didn't. There's always something happening, but. I have no good reason at this point not to show. I should show.
Marty,
I will.
You will be welcomed in open arms. People want to see you. They want to talk. It's more of a family reunion than a convention. People get together. They sit around and they enjoy the day and have a great time chit-chatting about the old days. And believe it or not, there's still some people that are making Coco hardware and actually running a side business on it that makes money.
I just was recently looking over some of the web evidence of that, and it was staggering. I mean, people are hooking up their compact flashes and their, I don't know, is there a SATA adapter to the color computer these days? That might be asking a little much, but IDE drives are being hooked to it and all that good stuff.
It's amazing what people are creating. A little project I'm toying around with right now, and I may, put it together and let somebody market it, is a floppy disk controller emulator. It's a card that you plug into Coco, and it reads and writes to a little SD card, and it's got a USB that hooks up to your PC computer, your Mac, and uses as a host. But the idea is, since it emulates the floppy disk controller at the hardware level, any software will work with it. You don't need drivers. You just plug it in, and the innards of the Coco will talk to it as if it's a floppy disk controller.
Tandy's Disk Basic.
Yep.
Or OS 9, if you wish.
And there's a mode in there that if you have a special OS 9 driver, you can even talk to the stuff faster. So, little things are being worked on. And I have to admit, Marty, just like you, I really love the good old days of the Cocoa. And, you know, the fest out there, you know, the last annual fest, is a way of a family reunion just to remember those days.
Just going back to the story you tell, what I do remember vividly, I don't remember every detail, but I do remember when I first caught sight of you, and I really wasn't sure whether this would come to blows or what. And I remember being very unsure of what to say when I first encountered you. That part I do remember quite vividly.
You were definitely nervous. I could see that.
And I'm not often nervous. I know you tell the story and emphasize how nervous I was. We could argue about that, but the fact of the matter is I was nervous, and it's rare that I am.
But, you know, as usual, like anybody else from California, and I really kind of think of myself more as a Northern California than a Southern California. The only reason why I stay down here is, you know, family, and also working with the entertainment industry. There's different things I've done throughout the years. And, even when I was going to college, I was a jungle boat captain on the jungle cruise at Disneyland, and I love Disneyland. And, you know, I was just there the other day watching one of my favorite bands playing Papa Do Rum Run. And then they invited us to go over to their house for New Year's Eve, and we got to sit around and listen to a bunch of 60s music as the band jammed.
As I recall, Steve, you were such an aficionado of Disneyland and attended it often enough so that one day you actually won a car at Disneyland.
That is correct. 1990, they were giving away a car a day, and on my birthday, I went down to Disneyland and won a car.
It was one of these little all-wheel drive thingers. I'm trying to remember the name of it.
They called it a Geo Tracker.
Tracker, now, that's right.
I won it in August, and I didn't get it until the following February.
Oh well. But you got it.
Eventually, I got it. There's a model year change, and they had to build it they had to build it directly, and there's a lot of issues in getting it.
This will amuse you. This is completely truth. For something like 10 years afterwards, whenever I saw a Geo Tracker, I thought of you. Truth.
Yeah. They were cute little cars. And, that's why I stay in Southern California, but my heart is really Northern California. That's where I belong. Walking into a Fry's store with the banner, "Welcome, high-tech professionals," just gets to my heart every time.
Well, you know, I would say Micro Center beats Fry's, but never mind. It's more of an East Coast thing. And just another thing about identity. Yeah, it's true. I've lived in Northern California since 1971, which is rather a long time. But the fact of it is, I still identify as a New Yorker and as a Brooklyn boy. So I should point that out.
I wouldn't say you're schizophrenic as far as your mind goes, but as far as when somebody meets you, they really do get a feeling you are Berkeley and you're Brooklyn. You basically got the free spirit of Berkeley.
You're gonna make something of that.
You expect that coming in, or get Luigi and do something.
So, Marty, do you remember the last Cocoa Fest you did attend?
I believe, I could be mistaken, but I believe it was one in New Jersey. Steve, can you tell me if I'm remembering this correctly? I think it may not have been the last one that was held, but it was one of the last ones, which was held, where was it? In Princeton. Princeton Cocoa Fest.
Yeah.
And that's the last one I recollect as having been at. There may have been one more after that, but that was certainly one of the last. Would you care to comment on that? Am I correct in remembering that?
You did attend the last Princeton show, and I think they did possibly two more Chicago shows after that.
Okay. Which was a little off my beaten orbit, and I think I failed to make those. I remember meeting Art there and visiting Art at his house because his father's house. His parents passed away, and now he actually inherited the house and lives there. But that's another story entirely. Anyway, yeah, that's I remember it was during wintry weather. I'm trying to remember. It's funny how something that far in the past, you don't always remember every last detail crystal clear. You remember, you have certain impressions, certain feels, certain smells, certain sense of temperature, certain brief interaction.
I have certain information that says it was actually Chicago in 92.
That may be. As I said, I may be blurring this.
Something about a party with Marty?
I won't deny it. That may be.
You may have showed up for one that was one of the last annual Cocoa Fests.
One of their first ones. I'm a little blurry on that detail. I should add that I still have a Cocoa 3 set up on a bench. I'm not sure how much longer it will be, but I do have one up and running, although its principal job is measuring the watt-hour capacity of various rechargeable batteries using some software and hardware I made for it. Anyways, oh well. But it is still chugging away, and every now and then it crashes, and I take the gimme chip out and plug it back in, and it works for another year.
I heard Boise.
Marty, this is Boise Pete.
Howdy.
I wanted to remind you that you did attend the 1992 Chicago Cocoa Fest because there was a party with Marty the Friday night before. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, my God, you're right. In fact, I was just going through, now that you mention it, I was just going through some various knickknacks around here in the house, and I found the name tag for that thing with the Party with Marty logo.
That was 18 years ago? My goodness. Yeah.
Oh, dear. Oh,
that was incidentally my first Cocoa Fest. I was 21 at the time. I never could afford to fly up and attend the various Rainbow Fests, but that was my first Cocoa Fest.
Ah, well, my beard is now white, and I'm even more bald, but I guess I'm still going strong.
Good deal.
So, Marty, you just mentioned that you still have a Cocoa 3 up and running. Of course, you had to move on. Did you go Mac or Windows?
I ended up with the micro splotch, WINDOZE. It seemed a more generic sort of system. Every ill thing they ever said about Microsoft, or almost every ill thing, is undoubtedly true. But the fact of the matter is, it's the standard, and it's economical, and that's what I'm using at the moment. That's what I continue to use. It's just a personal decision what works for one or another person. At some point I get tired with people taking massive principled stands for one or the other. They have their pros and cons.
Hey, Marty, on stands, I got one for you. This one guy on one of the Cocoa-type groups and like that was sitting there and saying all these bad things about Intel processors, how they're so horrible and cruddy and they cause all the problems and like that.
Little Indian socks.
And then he goes on to say, and this is why Apple would never use one of those. I posted, where have you been for the last 3 years? That's all Apple is using is Intel processors. And then the guy promptly went through and deleted that message and a whole bunch of other messages off the forum. He kind of crashed it.
I'm not a fan of rewriting history. There are those on the left who have been, but I've never held with them.
Yeah, but you know, that just shows there's this thing called processor wars, and a lot of Cocoa people are, I guess, they hate Microsoft because it was their Windows and the PC platform that essentially killed off the Cocoa. As far as Tandy was concerned, that's why Tandy stopped making it, and for that reason, they will never ever like Windows. Now, I'm using a MacBook Pro. True, I'm using Windows right now, but I've got a MacBook Pro. I've got another Mac. I've got my Windows systems. I've got my Cocoa set up. I still got an Amiga and an Atari ST and a bunch of other equipment like that. I mean, I've always, you know, when I was developing the Cocoa, I used Amiga and PCs in addition to Cocoa to get the software developed. And it was always about using what was available as far as software, and then I found the hardware that ran on it. But I have to admit, I've never gotten behind the Mac as much as the other people have.
I have another anecdote. I hope this isn't getting on too long. Tim, you asked earlier about, you know, what was my first experience with computers, and I told of my use of the IBM mainframe and the Monroe Bot 11 2000 in high school. And then, you know, I went off to college and didn't do much with computers, then went to medical school. And it happened that the medical school I went to was unusual among medical schools at the time, UCSD at the time, in that unlike most other medical schools, it asked its students to write a thesis. Generally speaking, that's something that PhD candidates do, but you don't ask MD candidates to do. To be sure, the thesis they wanted was not as elaborate as a PhD thesis, but they wanted a thesis or a thesis project. And at the time, I met this guy who was building this thing, a biomedical microcomputer, using this brand new chip from this new company that was headed by a friend of his. And he said, Marty, this is an incredible chip. I'm building this incredible thing. You know, why don't you write me some software for it? So I ended up writing in not machine, but assembly language, because he didn't have an assembler. A program that used interrupts and in real time sampled data from an electrocardiogram and looked at heartbeats and at least with some degree of accuracy could tell whether it was a normal or an abnormal beat. And it would ring an alarm in real time if it was seeing bunches of abnormal beats. And at that point, my storage was on EEPROM. My input was via pushing buttons and little LED number lights. And then, of course, the strip chart recorder and the EKG signal with the other inputs and outputs. And I actually got the bloody thing to work. I mean, more or less. It's not something you trust your life to, but it was working halfway creditably, at least as well as any of a number of other similar projects that others were doing with it. And my friend said to me, you know, Marty, the guy who made this chip, he's about to take the company public. He's about to go public with the company. You might want to invest some money in it. This is a completely true story. And so I didn't have any money. I was a medical student. I didn't have a dime. So I called my father, and it was the only time in his or my entire life that I ever called him with an investment suggestion. It's not like I was calling the guy every other day saying, here's a hot tip on the market, okay? One time in my entire life, I said, Dad, I really know computers. This chip is remarkable. It's a full-fledged central processor on a chip. It's the first thing of its kind. I can't be sure that this company will succeed. There are other companies that are doing it, but there aren't many. And, you know, I'm not asking you to invest all the family funds, but I know you have some small amount of money available that you can afford to lose. I really urge you to put it into this. Of course, the guy's name was Gordon Moore, and the company was Intel. And Dad refused, and I was told later by his broker that had he put $5,000 into it by the time he died and kept it there, which, by the way, was his habit. He tended to put money into something and not take it out. The estate would have been worth $100 million. As it was not. But that's another one of my early computer and stock market stories.
Well, we are coming to the close of this conference. I like to keep it at an hour. But before I let you go, I wanted to ask if you had gotten on Facebook yet, or if at all.
I have a Facebook account, which some people have discovered and asked to be friends with, but I've hardly ever visited it. Way back when Facebook started, I got very fearful of it because of all the accusations of misuse of data people put on it. And so rightly or wrongly, while I did sign on and put a very, very, very minimal, you know, filled in account, I haven't done much with it. Now that more and more of my friends seem to be using it assiduously, I'm probably going to start using my Facebook account, but haven't up through to now. It's there, though.
How about you, Steve?
I currently don't have a Facebook account. I'm in the same area that Leo Laporte was 6 months ago, where I still see Facebook as the evil empire, though through necessity, I will probably end up having to have a page just so I can stay in contact with folks. There's enough people out there that aren't that computer illiterate that see Facebook as the internet, which is a shame. There's so much more.
Facebook is sort of the AOL of the present era.
Yeah, we all have we know how we all feel about AOL.
Well, it was my first email account, so I have fond memories, actually, of that walled garden, so to speak.
Oh, Tim.
Tim. Boy. It's the internet version of hams and CB radios. You know, that's what it is.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, Steve. I like that.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody. I'm sorry. Continue.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, you have to be a ham to appreciate that. Go ahead, Tim. I'm sorry.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody for showing up. And this is the close of the Coordinated Color Computer Conference number 3.